Welcome to the AMR Studio, a podcast dedicated to the multidisciplinary research on antimicrobial resistance, hosted by the Uppsala Antibiotic Center. Hi, I am Eva Garmendia.
And I am Elin Fermier.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the AMR Studio. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Alberto Antonelli from Siena, Italy, about the work that he's been doing on AMR diagnostics and testing. We hope you enjoyed the interview as much as we did.
Hi there. Welcome, everyone, to a new interview. And we are sitting here at the AMR Studio with Alberto Antonelli. Welcome, Alberto.
Thanks. I'm very happy to be here talking with you all. I think that's a very beautiful opportunity and something new also for me.
Great. That's great. I hope that you come out of this interview with a good feeling. So can you introduce yourself to our audience? Tell us a little bit of who you are, where you are right now.
Yeah. Actually, I was born in Siena, in the middle of Tuscany, and I'm working in Florence since 10 years in the microbiology lab of Professor Rossolini. In our laboratory, we are working with antimicrobial resistance, so that's the perfect goal of the interview, I think. I studied medical biotechnologies in Siena. I've done my PhD both in Siena and Florence universities. These two cities are very close, 70 kilometers far from Siena to Florence, and since there I've done also my specialty in clinical microbiology, and in these 10 years I've done many research studies, mainly involved in antimicrobial resistance and characterization of multidrug resistant pathogens, and testing new rapid methodologies which can be validated in clinics, and also investigating the mechanisms of resistance. That's a part which is the most interesting, something related to basic research and something related to applied research.
All right, so we're going to get into details of the things that you're doing. But if we start back at the beginning, maybe not from where you were born in Siena, which sounds lovely, actually, there in the middle of Tuscany. But if you remember, how did you enter the world of resistance, or how did you, from the things that you were studying, move into this area?
That's a very good question. Actually, when I was younger, I liked it a lot, looking at movies, documentaries related to science. I liked to be researcher, study like biology or biotechnology, very related to new technologies. And when I started with medical biotechnologies studying in Siena, I wanted to be just a researcher or something of interest for science. But growing up with my studies, I became first of all fascinated by botanics, but it was still too complicated because I liked the genetic modified organisms, which were a little bit complicated because they are forbidden in Italy. Mm-hmm. So the professor said, okay, that's not a good idea here, you have to move. And then I said, okay, what can I modify and what can I study? The eukaryotic organisms are very complicated. Maybe I should start from prokaryotics. Mm-hmm. And then I had my bacteriology exam with the genetic modifying organisms and like cloning, mm-hmm. primer design. And I loved that subject that I decided to do something for my thesis on this subject. Mm-hmm. And this was 2009, so a lot of time ago. Then I continued also for my master's degree. And then, okay, I like it very much. And why bacteria? When I'm thinking about biology and I'm thinking about trying to understand how the organisms work, I think that it is very complicated to fully understand our nature. The human being is very complicated. And I said, okay, first of all, let's start to understand a single cell. Try to understand how it works. And if we can, in some way, manage to understand the molecular mechanism and the basis of, for example, resistance to antibiotics or virulence or metabolics. And then I found this very good laboratory working since many years on antimicrobial resistance, and I loved this subject and I continued until now. So
yeah, so we kind of have a similar background because I came into science loving evolution, and I did start studying evolution in eukaryotic organisms. And then I fell in love with using single cell organisms to study evolution because their generation times are so quick and the possibilities of manipulation of the genetic content to test hypotheses and to learn how they are is what really drove me also to bacteriology and then doing a PhD in bacteriology evolution. So very similar there. And we kind of end up in the same place. So that's great. So tell us a little bit about, you're here in Uppsala because you are going to teach on a workshop on a healthcare implementation with focus on AMR. And you are coming from the side of diagnostics, right? So tell us a little bit about what you're doing right now with diagnostics.
One of the most challenging issues inside hospitals is antimicrobial resistance, as you know, and especially in some settings like Italy, where we have, unfortunately, a high prevalence of multidrug resistant pathogens. We have to use as much as possible the new technologies to optimize our workflows. The issue of antimicrobial resistance is complex. We cannot solve it with only one solution. And we try to see different technologies applied at different workflows to improve the accuracy, the speed, and to also improve the amount of information that we obtain as early as possible. To reduce the turnaround time during our diagnostic workflows is fundamental to save time for the patient, but also to improve therapy. Mm-hmm. When we think about nosocomial infections in settings like Italy or other countries where the epidemiology of antimicrobial resistance is unfortunately not very favorable, in order to have a good therapy, we have to start as soon as possible with a targeted therapy, because empirical therapy is often misleading or with a lot of antibiotics, broad spectrum antibiotics, which are not always the best solution. And you want to have an information as soon as possible. Which information? The etiology, which is the microorganism, and which is the antimicrobial susceptibility testing. And to obtain this information, you can apply multiple strategies. First of all, you can use molecular biology. No, with molecular biology, we can obtain a lot of information. Like to, okay, I can directly from the sample and not by culture, I can obtain with the right way and as soon as possible the species name, okay, which is the pathogen involved in that infection, that precise infection. But this is not enough because just knowing the species is not related to which antimicrobials will work, especially in settings where you cannot predict very easily the phenotype. Then you want to know antimicrobial susceptibility testing, but the traditional antimicrobial susceptibility testing is very slow. It's dependent on the capability of the single cell to grow, and you have to be quick to obtain this information. Then if you wait 1 day, 2 days, it's too late in some cases. What I'm doing is trying new technologies that speed up that process, not only from the molecular point of view, but also from the phenotypic point of view, and trying these technologies to understand their accuracy in a very challenging setting like ours, with real samples, with real pathogens, and trying to understand their potentiality, which is not only related to which microorganisms are investigated or which antibiotics are investigated, but also how this information can help patients to solve this issue and to improve prognosis, which is the final goal. We cannot cope with all these new technologies without thinking also to the cost of these technologies, but we have to think about the cost of a life. So the cost of a technology is very, very small compared to a bad prognosis. So we have to think about the potentiality of these technologies, but at the same time, how they can improve our workflow. And that's something not so easy. But we are in a very beautiful moment, actually, because technologies are improving very fast. And 10 years ago, microbiology laboratories were completely different. And we have seen during the pandemics that we had a lot of issues with pathogens. Of course, they were viruses in that case. But even in that period, the main issue, at least in my country, but I think in many countries, was that patients with the SARS-CoV-2 infection had co-infections with antimicrobial resistant bacteria. And that was a very bad period because we were all concentrated to the problem of viruses and not to antimicrobial resistance. Now we are understanding the importance of this issue and trying to cope with that and to reduce the prevalence of these multidrug resistant pathogens with all the technology that we have. And one of the most interesting parts is that genomics is becoming more and more important and is solving many issues, not only for the retrospective characterization of pathogens, but also for the rapid investigation of pathogens. And that's something that will change completely the scenario, I think.
When you are talking that you're testing these new technologies, can you briefly tell us What are those technologies? What is the difference with the ways that laboratories have traditionally worked for this?
Yeah, actually, we have to think about the most important infections, the most severe infections, which are invasive infections. If we want to reduce the mortality of bloodstream infections, we have to speed up the process. Traditional process involves gram staining, culture, antimicrobial susceptibility testing, which can lead to a delay in the targeted therapy of days. What we can do with technologies to speed up this process to obtain rapid information. For example, some technologies are directly from the blood sample, investigating which are the most common pathogens, bacterial pathogens, fungi, and antimicrobial resistant determinants. But these technologies are still complicated to be used and very expensive. While when we think about blood culture, which is an enrichment step fundamental to obtain enough bacteria and to increase sensitivity, from positive blood culture, we can use a lot of technologies. And many different solutions have been made to obtain with syndromic panels, the rapid molecular testing results, like 1 hour after blood culture positivization, the most common pathogens, bacteria and fungi, the most common resistant mechanisms. And that's a good step, which is already in place in most laboratories. And actually, we are seeing another evolution, which is rapid phenotypic testing, rapid antibiogram solutions. And different companies created very nice technologies able to look at the single cell, bacterial cell, in a few hours, taken together with the different antibiotics and predicting the minimal inhibitory concentration in a range between 4 and 6 hours. And mm-hmm. that's a very, very good improvement compared to the 18 hours, which in general are the most common technology, the traditional technologies. And when we think about these new solutions, we want to make them work with the most challenging pathogens, which is why, for example, it's very difficult here in Sweden because you have a very good prevalence of multidrug susceptible pathogens. And that's why it's important to test these new technologies in challenging settings like Italy or even Spain mm-hmm. or Greece, where at least talking about Europe, mm-hmm. to understand their potentiality for solving issues with very, very complicated bacteria with different resistant mechanisms, different pathogens, and with also MIC values close to the breakpoint, which are the values which can differentiate between susceptibility and resistance. And these are the most challenging ones. Multidrug susceptible isolates are easy to be coped with because every therapy will work. But when you have complex resistant mechanisms and you have resistant pathogens, therapy choice is not so easy. It's not very well reached, especially when you have a very few effective antibiotics left. Mm-hmm. And we are also in a very good period for new antimicrobials. We have novel solutions, especially regarding beta-lactams. If you think about the most common antibiotics used worldwide, beta-lactams represent more than 40% of used antibiotics. And having new beta-lactam solutions together with beta-lactamase inhibitors, for example, is working very well to solve resistant issues. But these new drugs are not invincible, and we have to save them, we have to use them properly in order to save their efficacy and to reduce the selection pressure, the overuse, and and try to save them for the future, not only for the present. And that's something which in the past has not been done very well.
So a little bit more on the side of a stewardship also together yeah. with like how are we going to use these drugs, right?
There are two very important parts of coping with antimicrobial resistance. One is infection control, no? Trying to reduce the spread of this multidrug resistant pathogen just by screening people. And this is a very important issue that will be also part of the tomorrow workshop, I think. But when you think about antimicrobial stewardship, you have to think, okay, I want to use the proper antibiotic. I don't want to overuse antibiotics, which are not useful for that case. And in some cases, I want to downgrade to a less broader antibiotic therapy just to save the best solutions for the most challenging cases. But you have to know which is the pathogen, you have to know the resistant mechanism. This is why, in some cases, the phenotype is not enough. You want to know also the mechanism. And for this reason, I think that both technologies, syndromic panels, molecular biology, and phenotypic testing will go together to characterize these pathogens and to have this information, not only for epidemiological purposes, but also because actually, with the resistance mechanism, you can predict also some antimicrobials which are not present in current panels. Mm-hmm. The new antimicrobials are difficult to be tested in some cases. Think about cefiderocol, for example, a very challenging antibiotic which requires an iron-depleted broth. This is something very complicated for the laboratories. And then you have to know the resistance mechanism also, because these new beta-lactamase inhibitors are not working with all resistance mechanisms. And susceptibility in some cases is not enough. You can have susceptibility, but still in vivo use, not very, very clear functionality of this antibiotic. Then both information, molecular and phenotypic.
Most information, yeah. Embed the two of them, because I was actually going to say, when you were mentioning molecular versus phenotypic, you know, that I feel like we cannot rely only on the molecular part. Like, let's say that you are able to very quickly sequence a single cell that comes from an infection and see what potential resistant genes might be there. That doesn't have to 100% coincide with what's going to happen when you go in and treat that patient, right? So I think that...
That depends. I am very optimistic on genomics, since, yes, we don't know everything still, but we are learning. We are learning very fast, and we actually are able to predict susceptibility from the whole genome sequence of most antimicrobials, even if there are some exceptions. But another additional information which genomic can provide is the phylogenetic analysis. Mm-hmm. Think about this issue. You have an infection in a unit, okay? And this is from a multidrug-resistant Klebsiella pneumoniae, for example. After 2 days, you have another patient from the same unit with the same pathogen. But if you know only the phenotypic data, how can you be sure that this is the same pathogen? If you have a whole genome sequence and rapid whole genome sequence, you can stop a potential outbreak at the second case, not at the 10th. Okay. This is an outbreak prevention, which is still futuristic, but not so futuristic, because we have the technology. For example, the Oxford Nanopore technology gives you rapid sequencing information. Illumina is not so fast, even if it is still the reference method for many applications. But we are actually at the edge of a new era of the use of genomic data to save time, to improve knowledge, but also to prevent outbreaks, I think.
I'm very happy to hear that. If we talk a little bit more about the implementation side of these technologies, and from your experience, you say that you fall into the process of like trying these new technologies, seeing the potentiality for them. Since we have a technology and we know it works, and now we want to start using it widespread in hospitals or even primary care, if that would be the case of some technologies, what do you think is the hard point to break through in order for that to happen?
Experience, knowledge, and clinical impact. It seems to be like easy, but it's not easy, because when you apply a new technology, you have faster results, but you want to demonstrate that this fast result will have an impact on patients. I think that it will be important not only to carry out accuracy studies or comparison with reference method, for example, a reference broth microdilution method, but we also have to think about and create clinical studies looking at the impact on real patients, on real cases, to see which is the advantage of a technology. And possibly with multicentric studies, with different workflows, but looking at the same objective, which is the potentiality of this technology to improve lives.
Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit like we could think about it right now when there's a new drug, you know, we do clinical studies and we have to show that it's better than, or maybe not worse than, what we already have. So somewhat having the similar kind of process also for diagnostic technologies and the new technologies coming in into the field. Yeah.
Sure, that's the point. When you think about the new technology, okay, it works, but which is the final advantage? And that's the question we have to answer.
And that would be, you think, like a quantifiable number? It would be...
Yeah, we can quantify many variables. First of all, the prognosis for patients, the length of stay, and the antibiotic use. We can also quantify the reduction, the potential reduction in antibiotic usage, and also the reduction of inappropriate therapies. And that's another very important variable. All this information together will lead that to good knowledge of a new technology. But this has to be done, if possible, in challenging settings.
And when we are thinking about these potential clinical studies of implementation of new technologies, this could be done on prospect future cohort of patients, but cannot this also be done retrospectively somehow? like using samples that have been already stored in place and then kind of checking how, if we would analyze those samples with new technologies, we would have done something different?
In some cases, yes. When you think about whole genome sequencing bacteria, you can do it retrospectively on the stored isolates, clinical isolates. But when you think about and you want to change the usage of new technologies directly on samples, you need them to be in real time. Mm-hmm. You need the sample to be fresh, just, for example, positive blood culture. You need to process it like in a few hours. Otherwise, it will not be the same thing. Mm-hmm. And what you can do retrospectively is to select control patients. Mm-hmm. So patients which have not been treated with the new technology did not benefit of the new technology, but for the application of this potential novel and breakthrough technologies, you have to look at the new data, mm-hmm. I think, and to organize new clinical studies and to see if they work.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I'm happy to hear you saying that, you know, there is a way forward to be able to implement all these new great ideas that are coming up from labs in universities, from small companies.
And you know what is the problem? I think one of the problems could be the economic part, because we can use these new technologies if they are not very expensive. But at least at the beginning, we have to focus on critical patients. That's why these patients have the worst prognosis, higher mortality, and then we can use the best technologies as possible for them. But I think this is only the beginning, and we have to use the best technologies for all patients, mm-hmm. not only critical patients. Okay, we can start with them, but this is not the solution. The solution will be to use the best technologies for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hopefully we get there in the future. One thing that I'm curious about from your experience, and you talked about how, Greg, we're in an era where this is becoming more prevalent and there is a lot of ideas going on and new technologies coming up. From your point of view, what is something that you would like to see more of? What is lacking? Where would you like to see this field moving forward?
We only lack experience, but I think this is growing very fast. And I think that I'm very optimistic on this, because I think that the evolution of the new technologies will be side by side with the smart laboratories, which will adopt them as soon as possible. And I think that we have to be all together in this, not one country with a solution, another country. The antimicrobial resistant issue is worldwide. And the new technologies can save people everywhere. Of course, the impact will be higher in settings where we have the worst problems. But this is not to be only related to the epidemiology. I think that each laboratory has to try these new technologies, their potentiality, and think about the advantages in their own setting. And that's something which is not a challenge. It's like, okay, the best possible scenario that I can imagine.
Yeah, that sounds good. So I see you being optimistic, which I like. I like a lot, because as you were saying, AMR, antibiotic resistance, antimicrobial resistance, is a very complex issue. And sometimes we get a bit hung up on how many different angles can be used to find solutions and how can we integrate them together. And if we are falling short in one side, but we're doing a lot in another one, it might not actually work. Like, for example, bringing in more antibiotics to the field would not really work if we don't learn how to use them properly and how to have good stewardship around them. So I'm very happy to be talking to you that, you know, that you see that the things are going to get better, especially in the field that you're working in.
And just a last thing to be mentioned, which is the most important. The microbiologist alone is not enough. clinicians and microbiologists have to work together always in any moment, hopefully in a 24/7 workflow to save lives. And only if the clinicians understand fully the potentiality of the new technologies and learn together with the microbiologists the advantages, then we can obtain a good result. Otherwise, the microbiologist alone or the clinician alone are not enough.
Yeah, it needs a collaboration. And this is what, you know, our center and this podcast is about, which is seeing that, you know, people need to work together. Regarding that, if we talk just briefly about your experience working with other fields and with people from different disciplines than your own, something that we really like to ask all the people that pass through the studio is if there is anything in particular that you have found collaborators, people that you have been working with or talking to understand about the things that you are doing.
Yeah, I think that one of the most challenging parts is knowing the resistant mechanism, because it's very specialistic. But when you think about the issues that we are talking about, then antimicrobial resistance is something that it is very multidisciplinary. And many people from biomedical engineering, for example, many people from biology, pharmacy, medical schools, many different fields, of course, mostly scientific fields, are working on this daily to find solutions, bioinformatics. But I think that only the collaboration with different figures, different knowledge, can have the best results. Without this multidisciplinary approach, you miss something, and nobody can understand everything. No, we need each other, and with different experience and background, to grow up.
Yeah, my question was more on the side of, because you probably have worked with, you know, different kind of disciplines, if when you explain your work, for example, if there's anything in particular that it gets misunderstood or that is not so easily to be communicated to the other people for them to understand it.
I did not find any particular issue related to the field that I'm talking about, even if in some cases I think that this is only perceived as a nosocomial issue. This is not only a nosocomial issue. Antimicrobial resistance is an issue also in the community, even if a different impact. But we can think that a colonization from a multidrug resistant pathogen, for example, in some cases can last forever, like a diamond. No? I think that in that case, we should think about the impact everywhere in our society, not only inside the hospital, inside the bed, during hospitalization. The spread of these pathogens is an issue which should be related to everybody. And for all different jobs, all different backgrounds, they should think about a solution together with us to solve this issue. And then I think that I did not find particular issues on communicating this subject, just some superficiality for some problems which should be focused more.
But I think that point that you bring up, which is that sometimes when you have not been maybe working in the field for a long time, that you associate resistance with hospitals and in that setting, because that's also what it gets talked the most about. There's not enough about resistance in the news, but when it comes out, it's generally about these hospital outbreaks or problems with transmission in the hospitals. And I think it's good that we keep in mind, and that the people keep in mind, that, you know, it's not only in the hospitals that it can have an impact also in the community.
And another important part, resistance has no borders. A lot of people think, okay, this is not a problem of my country. That's not completely true, because people is moving, because diseases are moving. We saw it with the pandemic, with the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic, but also with bacteria. We have the same particular issue. Resistance has no borders. So we should stop thinking about an issue of only a single part of the world, because in a few days, resistance can spread everywhere.
Yeah.
We have to be very focused on, and with the eyes open.
Very true, very true. Unfortunately, we're running out of time now, but before we sign off, I would like to open the mic stage for you. If there's anything else that you would like to bring to our audience, anything that you want them to keep an eye on or to have in mind after finishing listening to us, now is your time.
Thanks. It has been an honor for me to participate in this interview. I think that all the main subjects have been covered, and I think that this podcast and this interview is something that gives some attention even more with this subject, which is a little bit underestimated. And I think that's the good way to proceed.
Great. We keep an eye on what you're doing, and we hope to see all those new ways of testing and diagnosing out there, spread out in the world, hopefully one day, as soon as possible. Thank you so much, Alberto, for being with us. And I'm really looking forward to the workshop tomorrow, actually.
Thank you.
Bye. Welcome back from the interview. So, as you heard at the beginning, our intro didn't really fit the podcast intro because Ellen is not yet back, and we have here Jacob with us once again. I guess you did enjoy the experience from the last month.
Yes, it's great to be back.
Great. Thank you so much for being here with us. I would like to know, I mean, you attended the workshop where Dr. Antonelli was teaching at, but what are your key takeaways from this interview?
I really appreciated a few aspects of the interview, and especially having attended in person his workshop. I liked that we had much more of a firsthand perspective of AMR from a more high impact setting. Like, he's from Southern Europe. We see that AMR is much more prevalent than it is here in Sweden, for example. And so I think it's much more personal in that aspect, maybe. I think he's also He has a very high level of expertise in this area, and I liked his story. I always love hearing their stories, how he originally wanted to go into GMOs, but because Italy is so proud of their food culture, they protect the food in that way. So he sort of took a different path and then went into AMR research. I think that, especially when we talk about diagnostics and testing, that he really underlined the importance of it. And I know that we here at the AMR studio always hear that a lot. And for when you're in the field, we talk about diagnostics as one of the core pillars of preventing AMR and good AMR stewardship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, first, I do think it's great to have people like him, as you're saying, super experienced, that are kind of like key people in working with these new technologies and testing them, as you're saying. Italy, sadly also Spain, Greece, Southern Europe, when we talk about the European region, are places with high prevalence of resistant genes and resistant bacterial strains. And it's not enough to test diagnostic tool, which is coming out from companies, for example, here in Uppsala, to test it in the Swedish setting, because it's so, so different than what is happening in the south of Europe. So you need to have people that know the context and know the place where this is having the most impact. And therefore, the use of these new technologies, new diagnostics, can also have the most impact, because that's where you need them the most. So having people like him, so engaged and with that experience, that can work with an array of different technologies and people as well, you know, I think it's great. But what you're really bringing up here after, with diagnostic being so key and central to everything we're talking about, I think I kind of knew about it, but listening to the interview, I feel like it kind of synthesizes for me, you know, why are diagnostics so important, not only for AMR, but for, you know, the health system altogether, right? Like, if we have good diagnostics that work quickly and give us as much information as we can know when to use antibiotics or use other kind of drugs. When we have to use antibiotics, we will be able to use the right ones without having to do change of therapy or using antibiotics that are not really needed to be used. We are also going to be able to do screenings and have different and perhaps more effective infection prevention and control methods that can prevent a spread and selection of resistance as well. And then we also, as he was saying, if we do these kind of genetic studies, we can have phylogenetic kind of testing or phylogenetic data that can even prevent outbreaks as early as 2-3 cases when they're happening. So can you imagine, like, how would the paradigm be completely shifted if these things would actually, these new technologies would be used everywhere quickly and they give you all the information you need? That's like kind of science fiction.
Right. And I think that that really underlines how maybe Italy is the perfect location to really have this type of new technologies being created, because you have this both high impact regions where they are heavily impacted by AMR, but at the same time, Italy is one of the largest GDPs in the world. It's a very high resource setting. And so they have the motivation to develop these new technologies. It's very high pressure on their system. But at the same time, they have the ability to use these very high technology, new science type of techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this also hopefully will lead to new innovations that we can then apply in many of the other regions, which maybe aren't as high resource, but still are highly impacted by AMR. I also think it kind of goes back to the analogy. If you think about, like, any time in human history when we have high pressure, we tend to develop things much more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this is the pressure that is needed, sort of being in this region where you have lots of cases of infections with resistance,
mm-hmm.
To really sort of have an impetus of new development.
Yeah, I mean, you will hope so, right? That, you know, but it's also sad that you have to get to this point for kind of things to come up and people to get creative and, like, the money to be put in the right place so these things can happen, be developed, be tested, and hopefully then be used for real in the clinics. But yeah, I think you're right. It has to go somewhere. It has to start somewhere. And then hopefully we can modify these technologies so they get to a price point, or they can get subsidized so they can also be used in other settings. Not a criticism, but I think we're still early on where, you know, this genetic testing is not just that it's still expensive by certain standards, depending, it's of course so much cheaper than it used to be, but still for some settings it might be too expensive. But I think also the need of have a proper laboratory setting and having electricity and so on and so forth, that might be things that are not accessible to everybody, is still a limitation for certain areas of the world. So how are we going to solve that, and where is this going to go? Can we have some alternatives to this? I think it's pretty exciting, and we'll see where we get there.
Right, and it goes back to what is the cost of a human life? But at the same time, when we're talking about antimicrobial resistance, we're also thinking about how many lives will we save by developing these new technologies
in the future.
Mm-hmm. And also by monitoring new pathogens.
Yeah. Data, as we had talked about last time, right? Also, yeah. It is true, very true. But I really, really like how optimistic he was, right? Through the interview, it was like, even though he comes from a very hard setting, you know, he sees this day in, day out, he works with the data, he works with the hospitals there and sees the impact that resistance has there. I think if a person like him can be that optimistic, we should also follow his lead, right?
Well, exactly. And I think that it goes back to why do scientists do what they do? And there's a passion there, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's great when we can, like through the AMR studio, share that passion with other people. Because I think lots of scientists really just talk to their colleagues and other scientists. But it's great that people from other fields get to hear what we're doing. And really, everyone's just a big kid.
Exactly. Doing. And getting a little bit of inspiration also for their own part. That's very true. I think with that, do you have anything else to talk about the interview, or should we move to our news section?
Let's move into the news section.
All right. So today in the news section, we have two articles, one more scientific, let's say lab-based, and one more theoretical, let's say. All right. See you there. Welcome to the news section for this month of April. Happy April, happy spring, right? I mean, it's very sunny out there, but it's still cold here. So, Jakob, we're going to start with your paper this month. And you are going to talk to us about something that we really, really enjoy here at the AMR Studio, which is how do we talk about resistance?
Yes.
So what are you bringing us this month?
So I'm bringing you a comment on infectious diseases, published on March 23rd, 2024, entitled "The Language of Antimicrobial and Antibiotic Resistance is Blocking Global Collective Action" by Matti Karvonen and the founder of React Auto Cars.
These are colleagues, also very important person globally on the quest within resistance. So why are they talking to us about? What are they saying?
Right. So it's very much a article about the dialogue and how do we discuss and convey AMR to the public and also just generally in the media.
Mm-hmm.
They begin by talking about the shortcomings we have, how difficult it is to discuss AMR, the different terminologies used. Sometimes we'll say AMR when we're talking about antibiotic resistance, ABR, and it's very confusing. And also they make lots of links to climate change.
Mm-hmm.
They discuss that, how it's a convenient analogy because both are impacting us in similar ways in that they're both natural phenomena caused by humans, which will eventually have a negative impact on our futures.
Mm-hmm.
And so they bring up the link directly between them, how actually climate change will directly impact the effect of AMR on all of us.
Mm-hmm.
So increasing global temperatures eventually will also lead to increased likelihood of infectious diseases. But then they also talk about how it's difficult to measure AMR in the same ways that we measure climate change. For example, you cannot have a 2-degree limit with international treaties to stop AMR. There's not a specific sort of
cutoff number,
yes,
that we can have as a target.
Have as a target internationally amongst countries.
Yeah, but in AMR or ABR, as we're saying, the targets would be more like visions, like always have working antibiotics or prevent as many infections as possible, that kind of like a bit more theoretical targets or goals rather than numbers per se that are much, much difficult in this area, I think.
Right. It's much more general, but at the same time, very specific goals.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
We're able to do that. And then the article goes into a series of strategies or the underlying arguments that can be used to convey AMR and how we discuss it, and they go into the classical rhetorics. So we have logos, ethos, and pathos.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about any argument, you can use these three rhetorics to improve your argument, or they at least they explain how the argument is perceived by other people.
Yeah, so I would say, because I do teach about using ethos, pathos, and logos as part of how scientists can present their work, because we sometimes forget that this art of persuasion that was developed by the Greeks really long time ago has elements that we can use to be better at how we communicate in general. And I think for science also works. So I was really happy to read that they are doing these analysis from that lens also for how we talk about resistance, right? And the logos, the ethos, and the pathos are just kind of the three legs of rhetorics,
right,
that we can use elements of these to create our argument and to create our thesis and our presentation on whatever it is that we're talking. So what are they bringing about, these ethos, logos, and pathos, when it comes to resistance? What do they say?
Right. So if we start with logos, so logos is about credible data that is clear and precisely conveyed, and having really well-defined terms that anyone can understand. So we need to talk about which patients are affected by AMR. We need to talk about the individual consequences of AMR. I think that's not correctly conveyed right now in society, and that's what they argue in this article. So it comes down to making sure, if you think about it more in layman's terms, it's making it understandable, but also making sure that everyone knows what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm,
so
properly,
we need more well-defined, in other words.
Yeah, like nowadays we have problems because, you know, we say AMR when we actually mean ABR, antibiotic resistance. We talk a lot about these attributable versus associated deaths with resistance. What does that mean? What do the numbers mean? So we have to present data that is much more relatable and understandable by whoever is on the other side of this communication. Yeah.
Right. So next we go into ethos. Mm-hmm. So that has more to do with the communicators and their credibility.
Mm-hmm.
We need to create trust between the people we're communicating with and the experts. They talk about some of the problems that we've faced in the past, specifically people not being reliable with their data, cherry-picking data,
mm-hmm.
having conflicts of interest. You know, we talk about antibiotics. That's a pharmaceutical drug.
Mm-hmm.
People may think that there's conflict of interest with big pharma. So we want to make sure that the sources are well-documented, that we create that trust by holding ourselves accountable,
mm-hmm.
and then being respectful of other points of view, and also understanding where the audience is coming from in civil society.
Mm-hmm.
So making sure that we have good local leaders who are collaborating with scientific experts, medical experts, to build bridges between.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in a sense, it's like who should be talking about this might differ a lot. And in some contexts, we might be thinking, oh, the scientist and the person doing the research, or this medical doctor that, you know, it's faced with resistance is the person that you want to be listening this from. But in some contexts, it might be different. You know, influencers, local leaders, in some contexts, maybe even religious leaders might be the people that have the trust in that community. And they are the ones that should be also part of talking about this to the different audiences. So really targeting these, who is talking to the people for different contexts, is really important and should not be understated. You know, that, you know, maybe the white coat scientist doesn't work equally well depending on where that person is talking and to whom.
Right. And then this kind of leads into the final point, pathos, which is the emotional aspect of the narrative,
yeah,
essentially.
I say pathos is the human side of communication. That's how,
right,
I like to put it, yeah.
Right, and what they want us to do better is to have better stories, I think, when we talk about AMR, really clearly show how this impacts individuals.
Yeah, I think the pathos, the power of pathos, is that it's the part of communication that makes you feel connected with what you are learning and listening to, or watching if it's a video, whatever it is the pathos aspects of it that makes you feel connected, that makes you feel like you want to do something about it, that there is some action. And I think if we really want to derive not just awareness when we're talking about AMR and people are learning about AMR, if we want to move from awareness to behavioral change, I think the pathos aspect is what needs to kind of be worked the most. And as you're saying, how do they propose that we get there? It's through
sharing personal stories about people who have had infections that were resistant.
Yeah.
Helping people to better understand how this personally will impact them. I think if we go back to the climate change analogy, it's much easier to look outside and see that the weather is different than it was a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But when we talk about AMR, that's something that's happening behind closed doors for a lot of people in the hospital.
Yeah.
The interview we had earlier, scientists see maybe much more personally and get much more frustrated because they see the data. And so that to them is their emotional connection to AMR.
To do
But for the everyday person, they don't see the impact in the same way. So how do we convey that message? How do we make it much more personal and bring it to the forefront of people's minds, which is, of course, always a challenge because there is a lot going on for the everyday person. How do you convince someone to take the time to at least to care about AMR in the way that maybe someone who's an expert and that's their entire life does?
Yeah, so that's through stories.
That's through stories.
Yeah, I guess.
And I think that one way that we can do that is maybe not everyone sees the impact of AMR, but they do. I think one topic that is commonly discussed right now in the media is sort of the fracturing of the healthcare system in a lot of Western countries, at least. And I think that when we talk about AMR, maybe we can connect that and say this is an added pressure onto an already strained healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to invest more money into the healthcare system. And part of that is actually preventative measures. So good diagnostic testing, as we talked about earlier, but also funding better hospitals, which is good for many different reasons, but also funding more science into this area and better stewardship, more government action in that way. And so that's where we combine these things. We need to build the trust, have good data, and then also make the story much more personal.
Yeah, yeah. Storytelling is very important. I lecture about this because I feel super, super connected and very enthusiastic about this. It's been shown through MRI that the way our brain works when we are listening or being presented with stories is different than when we're being presented just with hardcore fact and data. Maybe if we will put a scientist in that machine, it would be different. I don't know. But for the general average folk, listening to a story makes us work our brains in different ways and having different reactions to what we're being presented with. And I think we still haven't really harnessed all the power that that has when it comes to the mainstream conversation about resistance. So I think, to me, that's the main key point of this article and something that we need to think about. All of us that work in this, all of us that talk to a lot of people about this day in, day out, being either colleagues or people in our other social circles, use stories. Use stories so people will remember it better, people will feel more connected to it, and maybe people would do something about it.
Right, and we don't want it to get to the point where it's like cancer and every other person knows someone who's been personally impacted
by this.
Yeah,
we don't want to get there.
We really don't want to get there. Yeah. So if we can use it that way, and then so we don't need to use this sort of extremely everyone has a firsthand experience with AMR, that's what we're ultimately trying to avoid.
It feels like we humans are sometimes hard-headed, you know, and we don't really get things until we experience them, sadly, you know, as much as you're being told, you know,
right.
You don't until you go through it, which can be good in some instances and not so good in others. So let's not get there. Let's not get to the point where everybody knows someone that has a dead relative because of a resistant infection, please.
Right. And I was reading an article the other day about how so many of the past poems and great pieces of art are about love and war. And when we learn about history, we never talk about disease. But disease has killed more people than love and war throughout history.
Love and war. Yes, actually, John Rex has a very, in his newsletter and also in some of his videos when he talks about, it's very nice because he talks about how diseases have impacted different literature pieces or movies as well. And then you see them through the lens of like what happened like in Little Women, for example, or some other, you know, movies or novels where there's a lot of death by disease,
yes.
You know?
And we've forgotten about that,
yeah,
I think,
we have
largely.
Forgotten. We remember Jack the Ripper, but
yes,
we don't
remember
that bacteria that killed so many people, right? We need to be better at making stories around disease, I guess.
Yes. And on that positive note,
yeah, we're going to move to our next article.
So, Eva, what is the next article we will be talking about today?
Yeah, so this month I'm bringing you something close to home, something in-house, so to speak. It's a paper published by my boss, Don Anderson, together with Omar Warsi and Ramit Nair. So they're all colleagues here at the lab of Don Anderson. And it's published on Microbiology Spectrum Journal very recently, 27th of March of this year. And it has the title, Antibiotic Resistance Begets More Resistance. Chromosomal resistance mutation mitigate fitness costs conferred by multi-resistance clinical plasmids. And I got really excited when I saw that this paper was out, because if you have been with us at the podcast for 4 years and you remember a little bit of my past, I did start my PhD studying plasmids and studying the amelioration of plasmid cost in different contexts in bacteria. Amelioration, I just say it as a joke because it's such a technical word that I had to deal with so much, but it basically means to reduce. Ameliorate is to reduce. So I was trying to understand how plasmids that have a fitness cost come into a bacteria and can remain into that bacteria through changes and mutations that reduce the cost of that plasmid. That was basically my project. That project ended up nowhere because of other scientific and research challenges around it, but I still have a high interest in this area. I think it's so cool that these extra pieces of DNA that are plasmids that can do a lot of cool stuff and can make the bacteria do a lot of cool stuff, because they cannot really live by themselves. They have to be in a bacteria. They contain a lot of genes, and in many cases, they can contain many multiple genes that confer resistance to the bacteria. These pieces of DNA come in into a host, a bacteria, and sometimes, more often than not, they are costly. They are costly. That means that they make the bacteria grow less well than they would do without the plasmid, right? And plasmids are really important for the development and the evolution of resistance, because they can contain a lot of genes in that plasmid, but also because plasmids can be transferred from bacteria to bacteria. So when plasmids contain resistant genes, the resistance can be sent exponentially to a lot of bacteria horizontally, whereas chromosomal mutations that lead to resistance can only be, most generally, sent to other bacteria vertically, so from mother to daughter cell, so through generations of replication. But when they are in plasmids, plasmids that are conjugative, that means they can be sent to another bacteria, then they can send it also horizontally, which means that there might be a lot of bacteria, a lot of resistance out there. So I think it's really cool to understand how plasmids work. That is kind of the background, my background, and why I think this is interesting. This paper, when they went about, is through the premise that, okay, we have a plasmid that confers resistance. It could be a plasmid that has an extended spectrum beta-lactamase, for example. And if we put it into a laboratory strain that is susceptible to antibiotics, do this plasmid have a cost? And if we put that same plasmid into a laboratory strain that now is not susceptible but is resistant to other one or many antibiotics, does the plasmid have the same cost that it used to have in a susceptible host, or is it different? And if it's different, if it's not there anymore, can we actually understand why this is happening, right? So that's kind of the premise of this paper. And what they did was to actually use 13 different clinical plasmids. And these plasmids are coming either from E. coli or Klebsiella strains that actually infected people. So these are clinical strains. They took the plasmids that contain extended spectrum beta-lactamase genes, and then they put these 13 plasmids either in an E. coli that is completely susceptible in the lab, or an E. coli that is resistant to nitrofurantoin, an E. coli that is resistant to ciprofloxacin, an E. coli that is resistant to streptomycin. And all these resistance are given by mutations on the chromosome. So basically, the only difference between the susceptible strain and this resistant strain is different mutations on the chromosome that makes them resistant to these three different antibiotics. And now they look, okay, do the plasmid have a cause in the susceptible strain? Most of them, yes. Now, if you put those same plasmids into these resistant host backgrounds, is the cause still there? And no, the cause wasn't there. In some cases, the cause was reduced, or in some cases, even it seems like having the plasmid in makes the bacteria even a bit better. And what they did was to check also if we don't have antibiotics in the media, you know, would actually the strain that has a resistant background and has now the plasmid in it outcompete the susceptible strain? So would there be any selective advantage actually with no antibiotics, just growing in the media, if you will have a mix of a susceptible strain and a resistant strain, both having this plasmid in, which one would win? So over time, which one would get more accumulation of? And they saw that for some cases, the one that has a resistant background seems to be doing better, even in the absence of antibiotics, which altogether, this they tried to look into if they could see some correlations or relationship, trying to understand, you know, why does this happen? Is some maybe resistant background, either ciprofloxacin resistant, nitrofurantoin resistant, or streptomycin resistant, more prone to this? Seems to be all over the place. They cannot really, you know, say that they understand why this is happening, but they can see that this is happening, you know, that there is in the context that they are studying this, if there is a resistant mutation in the chromosome, seems like the plasmid, resistant plasmid has less cost, which, you know, could make that there is a faster accumulation of multidrug resistant bacteria out there. Because if you have a plasmid that moves to a susceptible strain and also moves to a resistant strain that are living all in the same environment, it seems like the resistant strain in certain cases might actually do better than the one that was previously susceptible once the plasmid comes in, which, you know, could lead to this accumulation, preferential accumulation of multidrug resistance versus going into a strain that didn't have resistance in the chromosome. So I just thought that it was pretty cool that they actually looked into this using these clinical plasmids. Of course, this is limited to the lab setting. They use minimal media, which is a very defined media, something that you can work with very precisely in the lab. We know out there in the body, in the waters, in the environment, things are different. But I think if this is a testament to anything, is that it's so complicated to understand the relationship between the plasmid and the host that is carrying the plasmid. And there are a lot of factors at play that have to do with expression of genes, expression of replication, of conjugation, of all these things that the plasmids are doing in this host. And if the host is slightly different, and in here it's just by even a point mutation that makes you resistant to these antibiotics, the effect is completely different. So yeah, in my PhD, I didn't get to learn almost anything, but because it's so difficult to actually understand it as right. Well. So this is the paper, and I thought it was, you know, I like plasmids, and I mean, it's not that I like plasmids, I just think they're very interesting and very important also in the resistance world as well.
Right, because bacteria can share their genes.
Yes.
Well, and I think it's great. I liked reading this paper because as much as everyone loves a definitive answer, yes. As a science, we get left with more questions.
Always.
But I think what was nice is that this was something a bit, for me at least, unexpected. We've changed our path a little bit because I've always thought, oh, having resistance genes leads to reduced fitness, or at least not increased fitness. So this was a completely opposite to what we would have expected. And I think that's always, it can be a lot of fun to see that. You know, you never know what you're going to get. So.
Which is fun in one sense, but actually pretty bad in
Scary.
Another sense, because you cannot really predict much of what's happening, especially with these plasmids. And it gets a bit, all over the place. But if you remember, we talked to Álvaro San Millán some episodes back also about, you know, plasmid and epidemiology of plasmids. And he's doing a really great work with very clear results. So yeah, people can work with plasmids and get some insights into how they work and how they move through populations and through strains. But it feels like when you put this variability inside, the results seem to be a little bit all over the place. Yeah. Great. So I think with that, we're done for the month of April. Cruising to better weather, I hope. And now this month of April, there's a lot of things coming up. For us at the center, we are bidding for a new round of the center. So we're working very hard to try to secure some funding for 2025 onwards. We are going to be present in a couple of courses teaching about AMR. We are going to go to ECMID in Barcelona at the end of the month. So on the next episode, we will actually be back from Barcelona. Maybe we will have a special episode about ECMID. We'll see how it goes at the conference. With that, we are almost in summer.
Yes. Great.
That's crazy that it was just December. A few moments ago, it was December, and now we're thinking about summer.
Yes, time is flying by.
Yeah, but looking forward for what the spring is going to bring to us here at the studio and at the center.
Yes, and with that, we wish you all a wonderful April.
Yeah, wonderful April.
And we'll see you next month.
Yeah, bye-bye. For more information about the Uppsala Antibiotic Center, please visit our website. You can find a link in the episode notes. You can also follow us in Twitter. Our handle is UAC_UU. This episode was brought to you by the AMR Studios, composed by Eva Garmendia, Jenny Jackman, and Po Chen Tang.
And a big thank you to Henrik Nys for letting us use his song, Sound the Alarm.